ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's rate of inflation has jumped. The official annual rate is now 3.2%, up from 2.1% a quarter earlier. From now on, the official rate will be updated monthly. This happens to be the last standalone quarterly measure. It's higher than it used to be, but perhaps not as high as many of us think it is. For many of us, inflation looks vast. Why is that? And what's wrong? The official figures or us? And where do those official figures even come from? Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and my guest this week, someone who understands the Consumer Price Index from the ground up, and who, as you'll hear, helped reconstruct it from the ground up, Kevin Fox, who heads the University of New South Wales Centre for Applied Economic Research, and someone who, like me, has been a long-time user of the official inflation figures, in her case at the Australian Treasury, the Victorian Treasury, and the ANZ Bank, and who now runs a new think tank called Policy Institute Australia, Amy Oster. Welcome, Kevin, and welcome back, Amy.
Thanks very much, Peter.
Great to be here, Peter.
Amy, a quick question to you first. This jump in inflation, the one we've just had, from 2.1% to 3.2%, is so big, it's now above the Reserve Bank's target band, that we won't get that cut in interest rates next week we'd been expecting. That's right, right?
That is 100% correct. Absolutely not.
You would stake your house on that?
Yes.
Kevin, a lot of us probably don't want to admit it, but we're not quite sure where the inflation figures come from. If we think about it at all, we probably think about staff from the Bureau of Statistics going into shops with pens and paper, writing down prices. That's what used to happen, right?
Yes.
And you were instrumental in the move away from those visits. But it raises a bigger question. Which prices are collected? That can make all the difference. A survey of the wrong things can make it look as if prices are soaring or scarcely rising. How does the Bureau know what prices to collect and in what proportions? How does it work it out?
Well, as you would imagine, the Australian Bureau of Statistics puts a lot of effort into working out what prices should be collected to reflect actual consumers' experiences with inflation, with prices. So they use a household expenditure survey as a benchmark, which they do every several years. And this tells them something from the household level, from household responses to the survey, what households are spending.
Every household, I think it's 10,000, every unlucky household who's picked to fill in a diary, or probably an electronic diary, of everything they spend, including things they spend less frequently, quarterly bills and so on.
Yes, fortunately it doesn't happen every year, and it doesn't go back to the same households so every time. So not too much of a burden on any particular household.
Are the results surprising, Amy? I ask this because most of us probably think our biggest expenditures, the ones we notice, are petrol, electricity, gas. What do we actually spend on according to the weightings? And what do we spend on, say, alcohol?
So alcohol is weighted at around 4%. And so things are weighted according to what is spent, but that doesn't necessarily reflect what a household spends on everything. For example, it doesn't include investment. It doesn't include what a household might spend on illegal activity, for example, recreational drugs. It also doesn't include gambling. And I had a bit of a giggle around what's happening with illicit tobacco because that has reduced the weight in the CPI. So it's a close proxy of how we direct our spending, but it's not an exact proxy and it's not really meant to be either.
In the fine print of the Bureau's documents, it says it doesn't price or measure the quality of prostitution and illegal drugs, because to do so would be dangerous, which I suppose is fair enough. But the 4.7% we spend on alcohol is actually more than we spend on petrol. I mean, not me, I don't spend much on alcohol, at least not that I'll admit to. More than we spend on petrol, more than we spend on electricity and gas taken together, as much as we spend on education. Why might it be that the prices we notice aren't necessarily the prices we spend on the most?
I think that has to do with the frequency of the purchase and the rate of change. And so when people, as you were saying, people start to wonder about whether the CPI is capturing the rate of change is because the things that they purchase frequently, when prices jump, they tend to expect to see that reflected in the CPI, which doesn't necessarily happen because it'll be a small percentage of the overall spend. But if I'm spending the same amount on my insurance, for example, month after month after month, I sort of don't notice that so much. And then if my electricity bill comes and it's a big increase, then I notice it. Or if I go to the grocery store every week and I buy the same thing of orange juice, which I personally do, I absolutely notice when that goes up by 50 cents. So I think it has to do with frequency and the rate of change.
Might it also be that we're noticing previous price rises? So we did have very big price rises after COVID, especially at the supermarket. And even though inflation in those products is much less high, we still notice them every time we go in. The Reserve Bank's chief economist, Sarah Hunter, said the other week she still gets shocked.
My personal price point on this is milk. Get it in the supermarket every week. Milk is an awful lot more expensive today than it was pre-COVID, and I still catch myself on that even now. The price of milk will not go back. Same thing for bread, other staples, petrol and so on. We've all kind of got to get used to that, but it does sting a bit, right, when you do your weekly shop and it just costs that much more. So that price level dynamic, we think, is weighing a bit on confidence, perhaps. We hope that that's going to abate away as inflation stays low. That's what we're trying to do, of course, and we all sort of adjust and get used to that.
Might that explain, Kevin, why many of us think inflation's very, very high, much higher than the 3.2% announced today, when for a lot of prices it's no longer climbing that much?
Yeah, there are certain products that we buy regularly that we pay attention to the price of, particularly things which we regard as non-discretionary, things like milk. But things which are discretionary, where we buy them because we really like them, we may pay less attention to because we really want those things.
You're saying when I get an ice cream, I feel good because I want the ice cream, whereas the electricity bill, that's not even connected with my use of electricity.
That might have something to do with it. And another thing, you know, going back to what you were talking about regarding the weights and the CPI, you know, you're saying these weights didn't really seem to reflect your own personal experience. We've got to remember that the CPI is for no one individual. It's for all households across Australia. So it's not a personalised inflation rate. And so we can all think that we don't spend on the things that the ABS thinks we do here. But this is not for any one individual. It's for all households across Australia as a whole. So that colours our view of what the CPI is reporting. You may think, well, if that's someone's inflation experience, it's not mine.
There is a glaring gap in the CPI, which means that it's almost certainly wrong, and that's housing, mortgages. Rents are included, although, Amy, what are rents? They're just a few percent, and I don't think any person who's renting will find they're a few percent of their budget. It's an average. But can you explain to me, Kevin, why mortgage payments aren't included? On the face of it, it seems indefensible.
Well, they were included until 1998. The thing is, inflation targeting came in as a goal for the Reserve Bank in the 1990s. There was a problem that emerged because if the Reserve Bank thinks that inflation is going up so that it had better increase the interest rates, then those mortgage payments in the CPI would go up. And then the RBA would be chasing its tail every time it increased interest rates, mortgage payments would go up, which means the CPI would go up.
We had an upward spiral, potentially.
Yes. So when that problem was realised, the mortgage repayments interest was taken out of the CPI.
That seems a bit bizarre, Amy, a bit like the tail wagging the dog. The CPI is less complete than it used to be because to make it complete would be inconvenient to the Reserve Bank. Does this justifiably give us less confidence in the CPI?
I understand the issue, but I can't really come up with another way around it. And I think going back to what the CPI is meant to include, the CPI is not meant to include purchases for investment. So you do get a certain amount of utility out of living in your house, but when you own it, it is also an asset.
There's something else that gets people who distrust the inflation figures really riled up, Kevin. It's the way the ABS treats changes to quality. Now, if a manufacturer boosts the size of a can of baked beans from 420 grams to 500 grams and doesn't adjust the price, it's correct to say that the price per unit has fallen and the ABS adjusts that. That's simple, right?
Yes, that's correct.
It gets more complicated when a new model laptop has twice as much memory as the one it replaced, or when cars have features they didn't have before. What does the Bureau do about those sort of quality changes? Does it cut the recorded price, even though the price hasn't changed?
It does do quality adjustment for personal computers. That's really the only thing that it uses, sophisticated hedonic regression-based modelling to adjust for the changes in the quality of personal computers. And that's because, you know, a laptop comes out that replaces an old one and it's got extra RAM in it, but it's still the same price and everything else is the same. Well, you're kind of getting more of a computer now than you were previously compared with the one that had less RAM. So you should do some adjustment for that. But a lot of that is implicit stuff and it's on a case-by-case basis.
It is difficult though, Amy, right? I think you were telling me about your parents. They're not going to be particularly interested in a doubling in the amount of RAM. They just want a laptop.
No, or, you know, the one that I'm going to buy my kids to throw at the wall at home. I don't care. You know, I don't need the extra sophistication. I just want the cheapest one on the market. So if the cheapest one is more expensive, that extra capacity is not something I'm interested in.
Is there a deeper problem with the consumer price index, Kevin? A hard-to-avoid problem that probably works in the consumer's favour. It pushes up the index probably by more than the prices we actually pay. When something goes up in price, we immediately switch to something cheaper. Yet most of the time, the consumer price index takes no account of that. Some of the estimates were big in the US, right?
Yeah, they came up with estimates like 3% for pharmaceuticals, 0.8% for chocolate bars. This is annual percentage points. 1.5% for coffee, 4.5% for ketchup, etc. And the ABS did some work looking into this as well and found potential biases for certain product categories like margarine, 4%, coffee, 3.15%, etc., looking at a very limited number of supermarkets in Brisbane in the 1990s.
Taking all this together, Amy, does this mean we should perhaps stop whining about the consumer price index, whining about how it understates increases, and quietly acknowledge that it might overstate some and that perhaps it's about right?
Look, I think the CPI is a really important mechanism to communicate what is happening across consumer price inflation across the economy. And I do think it broadly works. And just because we don't always believe every nuance of it doesn't mean it isn't broadly correct.
Being broadly correct is what we're about here on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin. Our guest this week, Kevin Fox, who helped revolutionise Australia's Consumer Price Index and is head of the University of New South Wales Centre for Applied Economic Research, and Amy Oster, who heads Policy Institute Australia. Kevin, it's time to hear about the revolution. 20 or 30 years ago, prices for the Consumer Price Index were collected almost entirely by field officers from the Bureau of Statistics. They'd visit stores, enter prices on handheld devices, about 100,000 prices each quarter. They had to limit themselves to certain prices. For bread, it was a few representative loaves. One was the average price of a sliced white 650 gram to 750 gram loaf. It now gets information from scanners at checkouts. There have been other changes as well. It gets rents from the computers of real estate agents, real-time data from petrol stations and so on. But with scanner data, it now has masses of data on the price of everything sold and the amounts of everything sold. That ought to make it easier. But to start with, it made things much more difficult. What was the problem the ABS discovered?
Yes, it's a case of you've got to be careful what you wish for. So having all that information is clearly better than not having it. What you get from that transactions level data, that scanner data from the supermarket checkouts, is prices and quantities. So it's not just collecting a price which is on the shelves. You get the price of a good which has actually been purchased, and you know the quantity that was purchased at that price. So that is gold, because you don't want to just be collecting prices of things that no one is buying. You want to be collecting prices that are sold, and you want to know their quantities, because those are useful weights to tell you how important those prices are when you construct your index. But if you have all this information and you plug it into standard index number formulae, what happens is they can shoot off in either a greatly upward direction or downward direction. They can become explosive.
Explosive?
So you can get 1,000% inflation a month, for example.
How? Why?
When goods go on sale, suddenly there's a big spike up in the quantities purchased. When the good comes off sale, well, consumers have already stockpiled their laundry detergent or whatever it was that went on sale. They don't want to buy when the price goes back to the regular price. And that can cause these indexes to go flying off in all sorts of directions.
Flying off how high? What were they finding?
Well, it depends on the product category. But you know, in some cases, we found in our experiments using the sort of data that you could get like 40,000% inflation a month.
They weren't going to publish that result.
They were not going to publish that. So that's a problem.
What did they do? How did they solve it at first?
Well, the first thing when statistical agencies got their hands on scanner data was to say, well, we can't use this directly into the consumer price index, but we don't have to send our people out to the stores anymore. What we can do is sample from the data, pretend as if we're going to the store, and so just pick out prices from the scanner data.
They threw most of the data away. That was their solution.
They'll throw away millions and millions of observations, yes. But they realized, well, this is not a very good solution to things. We'd like to be able to use all the information that we have. So in collaboration with the ABS, we at UNSW, a team, worked with people also from Statistics Netherlands, funded and supported by the Australian Research Council, to come up with a solution so that we could use all this data in the Consumer Price Index.
You solved a hitherto unsolved problem.
Yes, we did, and it was well received to the extent that it's now implemented in multiple countries, including in Australia, from quarter four 2017.
What did you do? And can you explain it simply?
Well, I'll try to do that, Peter. So when you construct a price index between, say, two periods, there are only two periods involved in that comparison. But you don't want to just compare two periods, you want to compare three periods. So how do you compare periods 1, 2, and 3? Well, you can compare period 1 with period 2, and then 2 with 3, and then compare 1 and 3 by going through 2, or you could compare 1 and 3 directly. The problem is with standard index numbers, you get different answers. When we get to comparing, say, countries, there's no natural ordering of them. So for that context, when we're trying to compare income and price levels across countries, a different class of index number has been developed, and they're called multilateral indexes. So what they do is they ensure that all the comparisons between those countries are consistent. So it doesn't matter if you compare country 1 with country 2 and then country 3, or just compare 1 to 3 directly, you'll get the same answer.
You found a way of applying multilateral indexes to the consumer price index.
That's right. And it wasn't straightforward, because a thing about the consumer price index is that it's non-revisable. It's one, the one statistics that national statistical offices do not revise unless there's been a terrible mistake.
So as a result of what Kevin has done, the index is very, very different in that it takes account quantities. Amy, tell me about bananas and the cyclone we had in Queensland and your daughter. in 2005.
My personal experience with the limits of substitution. So, in fact, next week, said daughter turns 21. So it was exactly about 20 years ago, I know, that we had this cyclone. And at that time, my daughter Eleanor was a beautiful six-month-old who also happened to be a pretty picky eater. And bananas were absolutely her main food group.
Essential for her.
100% essential, 100% non-discretionary. You know, we had to have bananas, and along comes this cyclone. And at one point, bananas were $12 a piece, if I remember correctly. I was the only person in Melbourne buying bananas. I mean, one at a time, but we had to keep going with those bananas.
Your inflation rate went through the roof, at least the fruit component thereof. And the problem then was that Australia's entire measured inflation rate went through the roof for fruit because bananas were weighted at the weight they always were. Even though hardly anyone, Amy excepted and Eleanor, were buying bananas because they generally weren't available. Kevin, will this no longer be an issue again?
Yeah, with using transactions data, you're capturing at the micro level people's substitution between products. So it is a much better way of doing things, which greatly mitigates this problem. And it has other advantages as well. For example, we don't have to worry about a cyclone. We had a COVID pandemic, which changed consumption patterns enormously. Fortunately, the ABS, having implemented this methodology in 2017, they were well prepared for that. So they did a very good job in capturing consumer substitution during the pandemic.
Beneath the hood, inflation is now different to what it was, and much more representative from now on of what we actually spend. If the price of something goes way up or way down and no one buys it, it's going to matter much less.
That's correct. For many goods, we are able to capture what is actually going on rather than making some guess.
Congratulations. Amy, this is an auspicious occasion. It's the end of the quarterly CPI, something we've had for the best part of a century. From now on, it's going to be monthly. The full thing, and it wouldn't have been possible were it not for the work that Kevin and others have been doing to make scanner and other data useful, because it's now cheap enough to prepare monthly. Is that a little change or a really useful change?
It is a really useful change. I'm excited.
Why?
Well, there are two countries in the world that don't publish monthly CPI data.
Only two?
Yeah, Australia and New Zealand. So we are leaving our club of two, and New Zealand is following us, actually. And I think in 2027, they've announced they're going to move to monthly CPI release. Why is this important? I think it just stands to reason that a number that comes out every 3 months has more weight on it, almost like less certainty, and it's harder to understand what it means than a number that comes out monthly. A data point that comes out every month, you can see what's happening with it, how it's tracking. You can look at the trend. You can understand what's happening in the data that's contributing to that data point. So I think for the RBA, this is, and I hope it is, a game changer. I mean, the RBA has a dual mandate, full employment and price stability. So for decades now, it's been operating on a monthly indicator for employment and unemployment and a quarterly indicator for inflation, which is already imbalanced. Of course, for the RBA, a rate rise is less popular than a rate cut. And so if you're going to put interest rates up, you want to be pretty sure that you need to do it. And so I think it's natural that the RBA would generally wait to, especially to raise rates, until they saw the evidence of that link between tighter employment conditions and inflation coming out in that quarterly figure. And I can tell you, because I've had a look, going back to 2000, so for the past 25 years, absolutely you can see that pattern in the RBA's rate decisions. So the quarterly CPI is released at the end of the month in April, July, and October and January. The decisions that follow are the first Tuesday of the month and the following months, May, August, November, and February. And we can see, if you go back and look at the number of times that the RBA made a rate decision, changed the cash rate, in those 4 months of May, August, November, and February, the number, it's double the average. And we should also remember, it's not just the RBA that looks at the inflation data and the, as we say, the channels of transmission for monetary policy. So the RBA sets the cash rate, but the bank bill rate and bond yields and the Australian dollar also are affected by inflation expectations. So more broadly, the cost of money for our economy, not just through the cash rate, but through broader interest rates, as well as directly through the exchange rate, are all affected by the read on inflation.
Kevin, this is a historic occasion, but it sounds as if a lot of the history has happened in earlier years and you've been part of it. Is the Consumer Price Index, do you think, as good as it could be, or is there more work beneath the hood to be done?
Oh, there are always things that could be tweaked, and it's a matter of funding. You know, the ABS has spent a lot of money moving to a monthly CPI. Fortunately, the use of transactions data made it a lot cheaper to make that change than otherwise. But, you know, there are always things that could be looked at. Quality adjustment, for example, something you raised earlier, Peter, that still needs some more work. And also regional price indexes. They could also be developed more.
Thank you both. Before we go, as is traditional on the program, any quick final thoughts to leave us with? Anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Amy?
I'm looking forward to seeing how this monthly indicator goes. We have had an informal monthly indicator from the ABS prior to the official one. So it will just be interesting to see how the new monthly CPI release evolves compared to the old quarterly and the one that was being used before. It's going to be very interesting to follow.
And whether the Reserve Bank trusts it for a while, because it would be right to have a bit of caution, I suppose. It's a cautious organisation. Kevin, anything to look out for?
Well, I'd note that the ABS is also a very cautious organisation. They put a huge amount of work into examining the methodology and potential changes to the methodology and the impact that will have. So, yes, I agree with Amy. That will be interesting to see and follow what happens with the full monthly CPI coming out. But also, there's something else which I'm interested in, and that's about a government inquiry which is currently ongoing, the Strategic Examination of Research and Development. So this is looking at Australia's research and development system.
This is supported by tax breaks, among other things, at the moment.
Yes. So there's a lot of public funding going into areas like health research and research and development tax incentives for businesses. There's also public funding going to universities for doing research. And what I am interested in is what is the most effective way of using those public funds if the policy goal is to increase productivity. And I know that you, Peter, and all our listeners will be very relieved to hear that I find that giving money to universities to conduct research is the best way of using public funds to support productivity growth in Australia.
I'm not saying you're wrong, Kevin, but you are from the University of New South Wales, the Centre for Applied Economic Research. Amy Oster is head of the New Policy Institute of Australia. Thank you both so much.
Thanks very much, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or live on ABC Radio National Thursdays. If you have any thoughts or questions or comments, no economic question is stupid, you can email us at theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. We've had several emails agreeing that Jackie's idea of a show on businesses' social license to operate is a cracker. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.